Legends were born surrounding mysterious lights seen in the sky flashing.
And we are back with my guest, Richard Hoagland, author of The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever. And we are talking about the recent NASA Mars Observer mission, which right now, even as we speak, is on the way to achieve orbit, hopefully in about 3 weeks. And you are listening to this. We've got Dana out on Jones Cable in Palmdale. Good evening, Dana.
Yes, hi, Don. Hi, Richard. Richard, I've seen the photos of the face on Mars and the pyramid-like structures there. I was going to ask your professional opinion. Is there any correlation that possibly between that and the pyramids?
I can barely hear you.
Oh.
Can you
see okay, me? What he was saying,
can you hear me out?
Richard. Yes, you're going to have to speak up
okay,
a little
I'm talking closer now.
That's good.
Okay, Richard.
Yes.
Let me repeat myself. I have seen the photographs of the face of Mars and the pyramid-like structures. I was going to ask your professional opinion. Do you think there's any other photographs, say, on the moon that you know of, or is there any correlation between the Mars pyramids and the pyramids on Egypt?
Well, we know there are correlations between the material of Sidonia, the pyramids, and Egypt because the mathematics are unmistakable now. If you look at the latitude of the large pyramid in the Sidonia complex, the five-sided pyramid that Errol Torin, a defense mapping, has so brilliantly analyzed with its regular proportions and geometry, the geocentric latitude of the apex, if you were standing in the center of the planet, sitting, looking out through the crust of Mars, through the apex of the pyramid, the latitude of that pyramid is 40.87 degrees north latitude. The trigonometric tangent, this mathematical function called a trigonometric tangent of that latitude, is 0.865. 0.865, as in addition to a tangent, can also be a sine or a cosine, if you remember your old trigonometry.
Right.
If it's a sine, it corresponds to another latitude, which turns out to be roughly 30 degrees latitude, and that is the latitude of the pyramids of Egypt. So the tangent of the monuments of Mars at Sidonia is equivalent to the sine of the latitude of the pyramids on the Giza Plateau here on Earth in Egypt.
Uh-huh. So
furthermore, there are all kinds of mathematical ratios around the Sidonia complex, which resolve down to E, the base of natural logarithms, divided by pi, which is the circumference of a circle compared to its diameter, 3.14159. If you divide those two, one into the other, you know, E divided by pi, you get this ratio, 0.865. 0.865 turns out to be the ratio of the north-south to east-west placement of the Sphinx in Egypt in relationship to the pyramids themselves. So there is no doubt there is a mathematical connection between the monuments of Mars and the monuments of Earth in Egypt. The big question is, why?
Oh, you forgot an important one, Dick.
Well, I'm sure I forgot a lot of them.
Cairo, what Cairo is.
Well, all right, and Cairo, well, see, now, this is an interesting departure point, because Mr. Ecker is going to invoke, as I have invoked in other places, mythology and etymology. And what I'm trying to stay with is mathematics, because you can fool the myths, you can fool the legends, you can fool the literary allusions. You cannot fool the mathematics. The mathematical connections are inviolate and are telling us.
But it is interesting nonetheless, Dick.
But it is interesting that once you have locked on to the mathematics, it turns out that the Arabic derivation of the city Cairo, where the pyramids on Earth are located in Egypt, is the corruption of the original Arabic root word El-Kahira. Cairo, El-Kahira, and El-Kahira means in Arabic Mars.
Yes, I would like to also know the mathematical probability of a planet being 50 million miles away and having those, like you were just saying, those probabilities, you know?
They're really very, very small. And again, if we only had an example of one, we would maybe raise an eyebrow, but we wouldn't get all hot and bothered.
Okay.
The fact is that we have found other sites on Earth that have equally important mathematical correspondences which again is overwhelming reason for Dr. Malin at this point to simply take the damn pictures.
You got it. Dana, okay. We have got to run along. Okay, the lines are lit up. You bet.
Thank
bye-bye.
You.
We're going to go to Bert in Burbank on Salmon's Cable. Good evening, Bert.
Hello, everyone. Maybe I've gotten the wrong program. Is this Geometry 101? I've got a homework problem I've got here, and I need it solved.
$5, $5.
Right. Richard, it's wonderful hearing you here, and your videotape has just absolutely been fascinating. Anybody who hasn't picked it up really should. They will get more of a math lesson, but I guarantee at the end they will be sitting in wonder at the relationships between that and the pyramid. And also what I wanted to ask you about was the additional corresponding measurements, angles, and so forth to the area near Stonehenge. You kind of left us up in the air on the video. What's the latest on that?
Well, before we go to that, Bert, I have one thing to say. Do you have, incidentally, on your cable there the Sci-Fi Channel?
No, I don't.
Well, I do. And you know whose videotape I see advertised on the Sci-Fi Channel?
I would
Mr. Hoagland's.
Yes. It's not only
but
on Sci-Fi Channel.
Do you hear it? Do you hear it advertised here on UFOs Tonight?
Oh.
That's the big question.
I see.
Okay, Dick, I tweet you.
Am I supposed to say something at this point, gentlemen?
I'm sorry, Barry. What was your question?
Well, just about, Richard, about the end of the video, pointing out you guys had just really started getting the math together between the Cydonia area and Mars and the area, I believe it's around Avesbury, right?
Avebury Silbury Hill, which is 8 miles north of Stonehenge.
Right. And now, what? First of all, tell them the relationships of the different trenches, stone monuments, and so forth that you found on Mars, and then what is the latest on that?
See, this is the problem, Bert, is you can't do this without the pictures. You know, it's like describing a spiral staircase without waving your arm. If you really want to see the data, you have to see the video briefings that we've given to NASA, or probably better yet, you know, the UN briefing that we gave last year at the United Nations, or most better yet, is that a phrase, guys?
Most better yet. That's
both
that's
of them.
Correct.
You know, volumes 1 and 2, and we have put these out on home video now. There is an 800 number, Don, which if you call it, you can get access to these videos. 1-800-424-0031. And then you'll see what Bert is talking about, because what we found last year was there appears to be a kind of a scale model in central England formed by the ancient henge monument of Avebury,
mm-hmm.
which is a 1 mile circumference mounded crater replica in the central plains of England there. And about a mile to the south of it, there is this 500 foot high conical hill. And if you do the geometry and the relationships between these two sets of objects, they correspond extraordinarily to the much larger scale crater and tholus on the eastern end of the Cydonia complex on the planet Mars, in terms of distance relationships, size relationships, and most important, the angular relationships and the key angle of 19.5 degrees, which is the central part of the math and the geometry and our means of analyzing and kind of filtering the signal from the noise.
Well, you know, Dick, there's an eerie similarity there between what you've just described in the UK with several of those ancient stone monuments and Zechariah Sitchin's most recent book, When Time Began, where he was giving a rundown on Stonehenge and a number of other sites around the world that figure into the astronomical and astrological.
Yeah, I have not seen the new book. I'm dying to see it because Sitchin has done some very good scholarship. I have some substantive disagreements with some of his interpretations, but he does know how to do research, and I'm looking forward. And you caught me at a disadvantage in that I have not read the book, but I'm not surprised that he is following this trail because it is a very fruitful area for serious research.
Absolutely.
Let me make one more comment and a little bit of an off question. I hope that, Richard, you are correct that Dr. Malin...
Malin, M-A-L-I-N.
Malin has some kind of something in his heart to where he's going to take these things and actually do something with him. But
let me stop you right there, all
yes.
right? one of our Mars mission members and a colleague who has done tremendous service on this in terms of the politics, has been writing letters to Golden, who's head of NASA,
yes,
to Cunningham, who is the Mars Observer Project Manager at JPL, to members of Congress, George Brown. I mean, he has been papering the landscape with very good letters. One of the letters he sent was to Dr. Malin, specifically requesting that he, in fact, give him a target list for the first 26-day mapping, giving him a priority assessment of what objects are on the list and why, and are the objects of Sidonia, the monuments of Mars, on the list. We were told as of last week, as of last Friday, gentlemen, two nights ago, by a Mars Observer Project public information officer out of NASA headquarters, that he had on his desk a draft copy of a letter that Malin had sent back to this Mars mission inquirer, Mars mission constituent, in which he did say that the Sidonia objects, the monuments so-called, have now been given priority status. This is as of the 26th of July, okay? That there are three reasons why he is going to be trying his level best to take the pictures. One, because they're geologically interesting. Okay, I'll go along with that. Number two, because they've excited tremendous public interest. That, of course, is an understatement. And three, and this is the important thing, gentlemen, because they evidence indications of artificiality. This represents the first time Michael Malin has been able to utter the words in 17 years on these particular objects, and it is something of a breakthrough. The problem is that he sent this letter back to headquarters to be vetted, to be kind of reviewed, and he has not sent it to our correspondent, but instead, as of Friday, he was ordered on an airplane to physically report to NASA headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, has Mike Malin himself now been caught in this ascending labyrinth, mm-hmm, of lies and deceit and deception, because he may have had his own agenda for keeping quiet, but now he is going to run into another level agenda, and maybe what comes out of the meeting is not going to be what we would hope.
Exactly. The man has a great deal to lose. He has a future set of grants from universities. He's got a future set of, obviously, government contracts. If he's got this one, he's probably set up for those coming in the future if everything goes according to the government or whoever. So I just have my hand up in the air and hope so much that he does come through with it, but boy, he's running up.
Well, we're going to be pushing on it, Bert. We've got to roll along. We've got other calls.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to go to Don in Glendale on Salmon's Cable. Good evening, Don.
Good evening, Don, and good evening, Richard. It's a great honor to be talking to the two of you tonight on the eve of such a momentous occasion that we are going to have the pictures being
taken. Fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be a bumpy flight.
Now, this is something I've been thinking about. Now, when these pictures get taken, and we do know that they will be taken,
May I stop you there? How do we know they will be taken?
Well,
give me your thinking.
Well, my thinking is that these guys have control, and they're just as interested in this as we are, right?
Okay, this is very important. I totally agree, Don, with the caller, that one of the reasons why we have a prayer of seeing these pictures is that the powers that be, somewhere within NASA, Malin and above, maybe even going considerably above NASA, there are people tonight who want to see these pictures as much as we do.
And we're
right?
going to recommend on how they can help with this process before the program is over. Is that correct?
Yep. Now, the next step is, in this society, we have discovered over the last 20 years, gentlemen, right, that if there are secrets, in this culture, they don't stay secrets very long. Presidents talk, admirals are caught, colonels are found out. You see what I mean? If those pictures come back, I have a feeling that somewhere, somehow, someone along the line is going to put a disc in the mail, and we're going to see those pictures. The problem is, if there are other people who decide that the downside risk of the images coming back to Earth are so great that they try to take steps to basically eliminate this spacecraft before it can take any pictures at all, or if they try to take the pictures at a time when no one is looking, so no one will ever know that they have been taken. That has been our greatest apprehension, which is why we've been monitoring the timeline very carefully, and we've now narrowed down the window of opportunity to when they can begin to take pictures, and the earliest is going to be October 28th, but more realistically, not till November 8th. What is stunning in this environment, where when the spacecraft begins to do its science is all important, we have another letter which was issued 2 weeks ago by a deputy administrator for NASA headquarters for legislative affairs. Two copies. One was sent to Senator Dianne Feinstein in response to an inquiry from a constituent who was a member of the Mars mission. Another was sent to Representative Norm Mineta, who was a representative from Central California. Both were California congressmen, right? It's very important to keep that in mind. To both of these representatives, the legislative assistant, whose name is Jeff Lawrence, officially said that no science was going to be acquired from Mars Observer until January 1994. Now, what happened to October 28th to the end of the year? You see what the pattern is leading us to suspect? Because you'd imagine that this legislative assistant would be telling a senator and a congressman from California, which is a state incredibly hit by aerospace and defense cutbacks, that NASA had achieved a stunning victory once again and had been able, with its engineering ingenuity and the brilliance of its scientists and all that, to save the taxpayer money and begin taking science early in a mission which was not technically supposed to begin until late December on the original timeline. But instead of bragging about how effective they are, this guy is telling everybody that nothing's going to happen till next year. It's a little bit like telling your best friends that you're going to throw a party at midnight, and you invite everybody at 8 o'clock, and when the rest of the people show up at midnight, there's no food left, and they realize the party went on without them. And that's what we have to prevent.
All right.
NASA throws a party, and they don't invite us.
I was going to ask you if you thought it would be possible. See, when the Mars Observer is communicating with Earth, it's doing so on radio frequencies. Would there be any way for anybody with the knowledge of the frequencies that they used and the exact, whatever, if they have encryption or what, to be able to get his own pictures from the pulling the radio signals out of the sky?
We have looked at this technically. It's very difficult. And the main reason it's difficult is because the signal is so weak, given the power, 20-watt transmitter.
Right, you need like a radio antenna, huh?
You need an antenna as big as several football fields. You need a huge deep space network antenna and a liquid hydrogen or helium-cooled Maser amplifier. And there aren't many of those lying around. If you have one in your backyard, you know, we're not talking your average satellite dish. So what we really have to do, and for point of principle, I really think we ought to do it this way, we have to force the Constitution to work for us. We have to force this government to be accountable to the people who are paying the bills, which are the American people.
Okay, guys, we have got to take a break. Don, I want to thank you for your call. Please, keep listening. Tell your friends about us.
Thank you, Richard.
You bet. And when we come back, Heather, are you there?
Yeah.
You've been waiting a long time.
I know.
I want to thank you for hanging on. We're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we come back, more of my guest this evening, Richard Hoagland. We've got more calls to take. And we are going back now to Dick and Heather in North Hollywood on United Artists. Okay, Heather, did you have a question for Dick?
Yeah, hi, guys. Dick, I never heard you exactly explain what the Billy Meyer controversy was.
Oh, well, I kind of assumed that anybody listening to Don had been well exposed to it over the years. Don, do you want to go for that?
Oh, Dick, you're the guest, my friend. I want to give you all the airtime that you can possibly handle.
Well, all right, let me try to encapsulate this. In the mid-70s, around 1975, a one-armed Swiss farmer on a little farm outside of a small town in the middle of Switzerland who rides a moped to and from various places.
Which would be tough to do with one arm.
Yeah. He basically began having, ostensibly, a series of contacts with a being named Samyasi that was human to, you know, five or six decimal places, who would land in one of these meadows in the middle of the woods, and would rendezvous with him on a prearranged, you know, contact schedule all around central Switzerland, and he would take photographs. He took thousands of photographs, I guess, in color.
Quite a few of them.
Over several years of the ship coming in for a landing, leaving, orbiting around trees, you know, performing minuets with other ships. He was given tremendous amounts of information, which are the so-called Billy Meyer contact notes. And as this information began to work its way through the UFO community, and the photographs, which are of stunning clarity and beauty and sharpness, and look for all the world as if they've been produced at, you know, one of Steven Spielberg's computer graphics consoles, there developed this raging debate within the UFO community that basically Meyer had to be faking, he had to be a liar, he had to be, you know, creating the most incredible hoax in the history of ufology, and he obviously could not be meeting with a humanoid being in the middle of a field in the middle of Switzerland.
Well, let me break in right there, Dick. There were some other very important questions about this particular case, Heather, that a lot of people were very concerned over. Number one, allegedly these visitors whom Meyer was interfacing with came from the star, from the Seven Sisters, the cluster of stars known as the Pleiades.
Which are 420 light years from the Earth.
Okay, thank you. And they're not only are they 400 light years plus from Earth, but they're exceedingly young to have developed planetary systems, much less sentient life.
Yeah, but that's not the point, because if
one of the big points.
No, it isn't, because if we're looking at
this is the UFO show, if I say it's a point, it's a point.
Not really. If we're looking at a migratory model for the monuments of Mars, the fact is that in the contact notes, in the discussion, the so-called Pleiadian made clear that the migration and seeding and colonization of the Pleiades was a second or third generational activity, and they did not originate in the Pleiades. So what was really interesting to me as an outsider looking at this from great distance was the fact that this case, which had the best evidence, stunning photography in color, not of one little ship, not of a blurred thing, but over and over again, I mean, like you'd go to a used car lot somewhere down. Remember Cal Worthington and his commercials?
Sure.
I mean, these were UFOs that practically had a sign, would you buy a used beam ship from this man behind them?
But there was more to it. This organization now has achieved almost a cult-like persona.
But not
there have been... No, wait a minute, Dick. Let me finish. There have been many, many people have gone to Switzerland to meet with Meyer, to videotape them, to talk to them, etc. And unless you have today a wallet with many, many bucks, you do not get in to see Billy. Not too long ago, as a matter of fact, a Japanese crew was over there, and they shot him walking up a hillside to the tune of about $25,000. So there are many, many questions that are going on with this particular case, not the least of which some of those photographs have been genuinely challenged as not being legitimate or genuine.
But that was now and this was then. And the fact is that from the beginning, the Billy Meyer phenomenology became the most intensely controversial of any single UFO case, George Adamski notwithstanding. And into this incredible maelstrom, Heather, this is my point.
Okay.
Michael Malin, conservative, anal retentive scientist, all right, walks in and puts his imprimatur that he can't prove the pictures are fake. This is the same person now who, up until last Friday, was running at Warp 9 from ever uttering the words, the monuments of Mars might possibly, given all the work, possibly be worthy of testing by simply taking new and better pictures. And I'm looking at the psychology and the incongruity of a man who would put himself on the horns of a very controversial UFO dilemma and would eschew any interest in verifying with his own camera potentially the most stunning scientific discovery of this or any other century.
It's called running with the party line, Dick. But did that answer your question, Heather?
Yeah, that answered the question, but so has this stuff been disproved or...
You mean the Billy Meyer stuff?
Right.
Well, I did not bring that up to discuss or to validate or to to even consider it in its own substance. That's a whole other program, and frankly, I have not spent the time on Billy Meyer that I spent on the Monuments to Mars, so I'm not really equipped. My point was that when you're dealing with scientists, normally they're rather a conservative lot. And what's intriguing to me is that this conservative guy, a grad student of a very conservative guy named Bruce Murray, turns around and puts his public reputation on the line by at least partially validating the authenticity of the photographs that Meyer took.
Right.
He then refuses, when he has the opportunity, to even consider photographing and proving the monuments of Mars are not there.
Dick,
because
you know
all
what?
He has to do is to say, look, you guys are crazy. I'm going to prove it on Thursday at 11 o'clock. We're going to take the pictures, and that'll be the end of it. And he has not done that up until now.
Dick,
why?
I just looked at the clock, and we're 2 minutes past the half-hour break. Boy, when we get rolling, we get rolling. Heather, we got to move along. We've got a lot more phone calls, but I want to thank you for tuning in, and hey, keep listening.
Legends were born surrounding mysterious lights seen in the sky flashing.
And we are back. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. My guest this evening is Richard Hoagland, noted science writer and author of The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever. And we have been talking about the NASA mission, Mars Observer spacecraft, that right now is en route to Mars, is going to be there in just about 3 weeks. Dick, all the phones are lit up here. So I'm just going to go ahead and start shooting through some of these calls.
Okay.
We've got Mike in Owensboro, Kentucky, who is listening to us on satellite. Good evening, Mike.
Hello, Don.
And Mike calls us every once in a while.
Yeah, Mike, I know Mike calls. Hi,
how
Mike.
How you doing, Dick?
Pretty good.
And what? What did you say? No, I heard it. Before I say anything about that, you know, I was just listening to your commercial about the Fife, Alabama. And I was down there a couple, 3 months ago myself, Don.
Is that right?
Some of that. Yeah. Pretty interesting going on down there.
It still is from what I hear.
Yeah, still going on. So, I want to ask you a question, Richard.
Okay.
Well, these photographs are going to be coming back that we talked about last night. What's to stop them after they get them from digitally changing them before they give them to the public?
Well, you know, this is, I went to see a movie, when was it, last week, In the Line of Fire with Clint Eastwood, which is a hell of a good movie. I recommend it. Not the least for which was a demonstration of digital computer image manipulation in the film.
Right.
There's a certain sequence where the bad guy, the villain, is made to age in the computer. And it's awesome what can be done now with digital imagery. It's also terrifying if you are trying to validate a scientific hypothesis that's based on digital imagery, and you have got to depend on the government to give you undoctored evidence. What is really frightful about the current plan is that the data is going to come from the spacecraft, go into Malin's computers, and sit there for an unspecified amount of time before we are privileged to get to see a few frames. And we have no accountability. There is no tracking of the evidence. It's a little bit as if in a capital crime, Don. You know, we allowed the gun and the defendant to go into a dark closet, and we hear this whirring sound of a lathe.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the gun comes out, the boring and all of the evidence in terms of the rifling on the bullets has been successfully removed. We need tracking every instant that these, from the time these pictures are taken till the time we get to see them. We need basically rules of evidence.
Well, this is the first time in the history of NASA unmanned missions where this is happening, isn't
it? Exactly, because every other mission with really crude
and
dumb
technology.
Well, I think
that has to be pointed out and
it
absolutely.
It is. We are going to
the public, though. The public, for the most part, I don't think is aware of this.
Well, the public has not been following. But going back to 1964 with the first Ranger missions to the moon, we have seen live or near real-time live television. On the Mars mission, NASA was so eager to show us what it was doing that even with crude Viticon cameras and the crude radio systems, they would build up the photographs line by line on television screens at JPL so we could watch not complete pictures, but pictures in the process of construction.
What is the party line on what the delay is, Dick?
It's been very difficult, but we're pressing them forthrightly for why the pictures cannot be converted instantly when they're received back on Earth at JPL and put up on the monitors and put up on the satellite and given to CNN and C-SPAN and whoever else, you know, wants to air them, so we can see these pictures. Because only by seeing them in real time or live, gentlemen, can we guarantee, Mike, that they will not tamper with them with some kind of digital facility. Now, let me tell you a stunning coincidence. We have talked tonight that Dr. Malin's optical laboratory, his offices, have been set up down in San Diego, California, miles away from any other planetary scientist and the project. Do you realize that right across the parking lot from Malin's office is one of the world's preeminent supercomputer facilities at the University of San Diego? And all it will take is for him to buy a line or buy time and give him a few hours or even minutes with these pictures. And I bet we could have Elvis dancing across the face.
Okay, Mike, I want to thank you for calling in. We've got to speed this up. All the lines are lit, but hey, keep those eyes to the skies and keep tuned in.
Sure will, Don. We missed you in the Richmond.
Well, I tell you, I wanted to be there and things just didn't work out.
We'll talk to you later.
Okay, Mike.
Thanks a lot, Richard.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye. Okay, we're going to go to Kathy in Ventura on Century Cable. Good evening, Kathy.
Hey, Don, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
Hey, I made it back in one piece in Area 51.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Saw a few things in the sky, so I'll drop you a line on that.
No little green men, though, huh?
No, just little lights in the sky.
Okay.
Mr. Hoagland, a couple of questions for you offhand.
All right.
I read recently in some UFO material that I got a hold of that one of the reasons NASA's having kittens regarding these Mars photos is that there supposedly is already a U.S. base established there that no one knows about but NASA.
Okay.
Is that a true...
I don't think so, and Don and I and many others have gone around on this, and let me try to give you a short, succinct, what I hope is a logical answer.
Okay.
I think that's part of the weird, rampant disinformation that is being spread so that nobody can figure their upside from their downside on this whole issue. If we had the U.S. government had established bases on Mars as far back as the 1960s, which is one story making the rounds from a certain UFO person, then I find it inconceivable that that government would have allowed NASA to, A, send several missions with cameras to Mars, first of all, and B, they would have allowed them to photograph these stunning, artificial-looking things. Not once, but we've got two sets of high-resolution pictures in the files. Furthermore, they would not have left those pictures in the archive, not just at one place, but we found the same pictures in archives from one end of the country to the other. I mean, that boggles my mind if there is a coordinated conspiracy to keep us from knowing there are alien bases that we have built on Mars, that somebody wouldn't have figured out, you know, guys, if we're going to send spacecraft, somebody might take pictures we don't want them to take. So I frankly think that all this nonsense about bases is frankly that. It's nonsense to keep us from focusing on the real information, which is, we naively sent spacecraft out into the solar system, and they photographed stunning things, and in retrospect, in hindsight, in playing catch-up ball, there are some people who are preventing us now, or trying to prevent us from verifying what we have found.
And in, one other thing, I also heard the same thing, basically, is regarding the backside of the moon. I had read an article where a gentleman had tried to acquire some photos of the backside of the moon for a project he was doing. And when he sent the request to NASA, he said he got all kinds of bizarre reactions. But, you know,
well, on that one, I'm going to be a little more tempered, all right? We have begun recently, in the last, I'd say, 6 months, to look at some of the lunar photography. We have tons and tons of lunar photography. And the reason we got into this is that we found some mathematical clues, and I come back to the geometry lesson that Bert was gently ribbing me about earlier,
right?
Because the essence of good science is good mathematical analysis. In some of the data we have developed at Sidonia, there were indications that if we were to look on other objects in the solar system at certain latitudes, we may find something. And when we looked on the moon, on certain sets of pictures, which we're not going to discuss tonight, so don't get your hopes up yet.
Okay, that's fine.
We have found indications that, in fact, there could be something pretty interesting there. We have since gone through several different channels to get corroborating data, and what we have discovered is, depending upon the source and the center and the archive, some of the data is in excellent, pristine form, and other data has been tampered with. And we're keeping a careful record of who does what with whom. And at the appropriate time, when our analysis is more mature, we may have something to say on the subject.
Okay. Kathy, thank you for your phone call.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Keep listening. You betcha. Okay. We're going to go to Dave in Newport Beach on Comcast. But if you'd like to speak to my guest this evening, and you're in the 818-213 or 310 area codes, we have a couple of open lines right now. You can reach us. And we have Dave in Newport Beach. Good evening, Dave.
Hi, Don. I had a question for Mr. Hoagland, and I've had this question actually for him for quite some time and have never gotten a chance to get through to ask him anything about
it. Okay. Now's your chance.
Okay, great. Mr. Hoagland, I was wondering if you are familiar with the New York Times article from the 20s that talks about a face that they a radio signal of a face they received.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, could you comment on that? Because I have the article here in front of me, and I found it fairly amazing.
It is fairly amazing, and it actually probably would not be beyond the realm that we ought to describe. In the 1920s, in 1924, in August, as a matter of
August
fact...
August 28th, right.
Mars came closer to the Earth than it has or will any time in this century. Every 17 years, Mars can come closer, and every, I don't know, however many hundred years, the orbit cycles get so that you really get just a little bit closer, and Mars on that particular night was 34,630,000 miles from Earth. And there was a great deal of excitement. I mean, they didn't have television, they didn't have CNN, they didn't have the wire services, but there was a tremendous excitement among ordinary folks about the idea that Mars was going to be visible, and astronomers were talking, newspapers ran articles, and there was one astronomer named Dr. David Todd, who reminds me, Don, of the kind of Carl Sagan of his day. This was a really enterprising scientist who had done on previous opposition, because Mars comes pretty close every 2 years, he had done all kinds of things to basically try to detect life on Mars, including one balloon flight 10,000 feet over Kansas City with a radio receiving set trying to get above the atmospherics to basically get a clear signal.
Is that right?
Yep. And we've got all the stories from the Scientific American, Popular Science Monthly, New York Times. I mean, this was an incredibly interesting era when people were not afraid to talk openly about the possibility that there might be Martians and they might want to communicate, and the preferred method might be radio, which then, by the way, was not voice, all right? We were not listening to Amos and Andy in the 1920s.
Right.
It was dot-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
It
was Morse code, all right? And it was very bad Morse code because it was way down in the noise. During the week of the opposition of 1924, at radio stations, receiving stations as widely separated as Paris, London, Vancouver, and Washington, D.C., a series of very powerful coded transmissions were received at all stations and recorded.
All stations.
And they were so loud that they blew all the other stations off the air. You know how if you have a radio receiver, of course, people who don't listen to crystal sets anymore, like my dad and my grandfather, won't know what I'm talking about, but you used to lie in bed at night and listen to a little radio under the covers as you were falling to sleep, and loud stations, close stations, would tend to blow away weak stations. They would kind of take the air and become the dominant source of information, the signal.
Right.
They would overwhelm the faint signals. Well, man-made signals back in the 20s were very weak because our technology was very primitive. these signals, according to the reports by these seasoned observers and radio people, electronic engineers, were strong enough to swamp and overwhelm the natural signals, not only the natural signals like thunderstorms and interference, but also the artificial signals that were being generated by primarily government radio stations and one radio station in Washington, WRC, owned by the Radio Corporation of America, RCA. In 1924, at August 28th, the night of the closest approach, Todd managed to arrange for the U.S. Navy, which is an interesting thing to think about, which was the most powerful transmitter of information by radio, to, for 5 minutes every hour, go off the air and maintain radio silence. He also got RCA to take its station off the air, so that basically he got a shutdown worldwide of artificial radio signals. And in that period of time, these stations, Paris, London, Vancouver, Washington, and a couple, three others, were listening and recording what they heard. And what they heard was very interesting. They heard a series of very powerful coded signals that, and this is critically important, appeared equally strong at all these widely separated points. And this is reported, as the caller is saying,
simultaneously?
Simultaneously.
Yeah, Don, if I may elaborate just a bit, Richard's completely, I mean, he must know this article verbatim because that's exactly
well,
what
it's been
it
something that I've carefully researched because it is relevant. As we'll get to in a minute.
The brief paragraph here, Don, if I may, for the listeners, because this is extremely relevant. The film, 30 feet long and 6 inches wide.
No. Don't talk about that yet. Let me finish what I'm going to say. Don't, you know, because that's the coup de grace on the story,
okay,
all right?
Great.
And let me do the setup, and then you can read the paragraph. Great. These guys were listening to code, like Morse code, except much louder. Now, if I have an artificial transmitter, a man-made transmitter on the Earth, follow me carefully, gentlemen. And let's say that it's a powerful, independent, you know, industrialist who has the money to have his own rig in Poughkeepsie, and he were to send out during these radio silence periods, for 5 minutes every hour, his own signal to kind of try to hoax what was going on. Then the radio stations receiving in London, in Paris, I think there was also one in Italy, if I'm not mistaken, they would have received different strength signals depending upon where, as it bounced around the Earth between the ionosphere and the surface of the Earth, the radio mirror above the Earth, about 80 miles, like ripples in a pond when you throw a pebble, some places would have gotten strong signal and other places would have gotten weak signal, all right? But all the stations reported simultaneously equally powerful signals, so powerful that it literally swamped any other signal, including natural background thunderstorms. That indicates that the source of the transmission, gentlemen, was not on planet Earth, unless whoever was doing it was as powerful and as rich as the U.S. government and the Navy and had transmitters all over the world.
Exactly.
You see what I mean?
It sounds like it may have been from either orbit or right outside.
In other words, you needed a source that was illuminating the entire hemisphere with a frequency low enough to pass through the ionosphere and to be recorded by these widely separated ground stations. Now, another thing Todd did was to convince a famed inventor, Francis Jenkins, who was the inventor basically of the first primitive television, and who had developed a device which was a kind of a photographic equivalent of the first fax machine, to try to record on this optical gadget, which used photographic film slowly unwinding in a sealed box, to record what he heard that night. And that's now when you can read the paragraph from the New York Times.
Okay, it says, the film, 30 feet long and 6 inches wide, discloses on black and white at fairly regular arrangement of dots and dashes along one side, but on the other side, at almost evenly spaced intervals, are curiously jumbled groups, each taking the form of a crudely drawn face. The film shows a repetition at intervals of about a half an hour of what appears to be a man's face. It's a freak which we can't explain at this time. Hypothesis.
And the synchronicity of that is almost overwhelming.
Yeah, now if any of the listeners want to look this up, because I obtained it from the library, anybody that has an archives of New York Times on microfiche, It's from Thursday, August 28th, 1924. And with that, I want to thank you, Richard, very much for all the explanation. We appreciated it.
Well, here is the coup de grace. Okay.
Thank you, Dave. I'm going to try to squeeze in one, perhaps two more, Dick, if we can make these quick calls. Okay. Let me go to John in Studio City, who's been patiently waiting. Good evening, John.
Good evening. Very quickly, because I know we're running out of time. I was wondering, you've spoken about the Viking, and you've spoken, of course, about the upcoming Observer. What information do you have, Mr. Hoagland, about the Phobos probe, which was allegedly shot down? And, I'm getting the chuckles again.
Now, the reason I'm laughing is because Don and I have agreed to disagree on this.
Big time.
I mean, what would happen if, if we went over Sidonia, and all of a sudden the screens went blank?
What you have to remember is when the Soviet Union mounted in 1988 these two unmanned probes, Phobos 1 and 2, which were designed to go into close Mars orbit and then rendezvous with the Martian moon Phobos, the inner moon, ergo the name, it was done in a very closed society. All right, it was done in a rigid authoritarian atmosphere. It was done in a security state, right?
That's correct.
The Mars Observer mission is being conducted by the United States of America, where we know if you really give a damn, if you ask the right question, somebody will leak to you for a price, which means information cannot come back from this spacecraft without somehow finding its way into our computers. So, knowing this, the powers that be, if there is an agenda to keep this information from the American people, have a very critical choice to make. Do they want to know as badly or worse what's lying on Mars tonight than we do? And are they willing to chance that they can acquire that information and keep us from having the information before something untoward and untimely happens to Mars Observer, like it happened or supposedly happened to Phobos 2?
And what is the disagreement that you two have?
The disagreement is that there is a story making the rounds of Phobos 2 was shot down by an alien spacecraft.
Well, maybe not shot down, but
And I think that Phobos 2, frankly, succumbed to bureaucratic suppression, and that nothing happened to Phobos 2. A security curtain simply went down across the mission when the mission planners saw actual evidence that, in fact, Mars had artifacts and had previously had inhabitants.
Well, I don't doubt, Dick, for one second that part of that statement may in fact be true, but what they saw was that there was somebody still there or just returned.
No, now, that's not what they saw, and we can disagree on the evidence, all right?
And we will. And, hey, I want to thank you, John, for the patience.
Thank you. It's been very interesting tonight.
I've got one more call here I want to try to get to. Jennifer in Palmdale on Jones.
Yes, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
My question is, I have the little picture, my only picture of the faces in Genesis Revisited by Zechariah Sitchin, and I always wanted a nice big 8x10 glossy of the face. Is there any way that I can get that?
Yeah, you write to the Mars mission, and we'll see what we can do, all right?
This would be a good time to give that address out, Dick.
Okay, it's the Mars mission, 122 Dodd Street, D-O-D-D Street, Weehawken, Weehawken, New Jersey, 07087. There are much better versions, by the way, in my book, The Monuments of Mars, which you can find at any good bookstore. Or you can call the 800 number, and you can get the book and the video through the 800 number, which is 1-800-424-0031.
Okay, great. I'm definitely going to get the book. Thanks.
Okay, Jennifer. Thank you. Keep listening. We're going to go to Stan in Sun Valley, and this will have to be the last call of the night. Stan,
hi, Don. Great show.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Hoagland,
yes, sir.
I read your book last year, and I found it very interesting, but it occurs to me that they could even fool the good Dr. Malin. As you well know, the dishes at JPL aren't large enough for deep space reception. They're probably picking it up at Goldstone. And I'm pretty sure, from your experience of being at JPL, you know most of the data is sent down to the Marshall Center and to Houston over a high-speed encrypted data link, and then it's uplinked through several transponders on several other satellites. So easily the data could be massaged before the guy down in San Diego gets it.
It's conceivable, but we have some cross-checks. I mean, if they try to pull a number and give us scanned photos, we think we can catch it.
Uh-huh.
The key is timing. It's very difficult to pull an elaborate hoax in real time. We
Dick,
don't have the computer power to do it.
You
in
said
real time.
The magic word, Dick, timing, and we are now out of it. I'm
well,
going to put you
thank
on.
Thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Don Ecker Live.
Well, you heard it. It was from Larry King himself. Stan, I want to thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Keep listening. All right, Dick, hang on, please. Okay, that is it for another week. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight on the cable. You know, it was 6 months ago we were saying that an hour wasn't long enough. We needed 2 hours. It's obvious tonight we could use another hour yet. So look, I want you to keep your eyes to the skies. Tune in again in 1 week. My guest next week, Dr. Bruce Maccabee, we're going to be talking about his links, covert links, to the CIA. The man's been talking to them for 14 years while he's been doing public UFO research. What is going on? Stay tuned, and we'll see you in a week.